Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonstories.org. Hello and welcome back to part four of this Mormon Stories series on the psychology of religion with Dr. James Nagel. I'm John DeLynn, your host. Hey, James.
Hello.
Again, as this is part four, I'd like to remind you guys to listen to parts one, two, and three if you can. Also want to remind you that there are some fantastic visuals accompanying these four episodes. You can either download the PowerPoints at mormonstories.org, or you can go up to YouTube and watch this thing in full multimedia splendor at youtube.com/mormonstories. I encourage you to do that as well, because it might help you understand. But we're going to still try and speak in a way to where the audio-only audience will still benefit. So, James, it seems like we've laid out kind of a framework in episodes 1 through 3. Is it fair to say that this fourth part is sort of just a conclusion?
Yeah, we're basically going to just tie it all together and really answer that ultimate question of, you know, where do spiritual supernatural beliefs originate from? What is the abiogenesis of religion and culture?
All right.
So that's going to really tie it all together and hopefully explain a lot about the way people look at the world.
Okay, cool. Well, let's start with signs from God.
Okay, so you remember where we left off was this idea of primacy and how, and how coupled with need for closure, it causes people to get an idea in their head and latch on to the first thing that comes along.
Right.
So what we're going to show in the next few slides is how not only is, you know, a religious answer sort of a popular one, it's kind of the default place your brain goes to explain things, that agents are in charge of things. Okay.
So what to kind of apply this, if we're taught from an early age to see God in everything, mm-hmm. and we have this tendency to not want to deal with uncertainty, and so we apply the God of the gaps sort of, tendency, then we're sort of primed to see signs and evidence of God everywhere. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but I'm also kind of taking it one step further in that even if nobody taught you any religion your entire life, you were born on a desert island, okay, and raised by wolves, you would still have this innate sense to want to look for agents as the explanation for everything in your world.
Got it.
And that God is just kind of a development from that base concept.
Okay, cool.
Okay, so this next set of experiments was kind of inspired when I saw this poll on the news here. So I have a screenshot from Fox News where the reporter is talking about a poll conducted by the Public Religion Research Institute. And this was in last year, actually, March 2011. And they showed that 4 out of 10 Americans, when they see natural disasters and hurricanes, like hurricanes and earthquakes and tornadoes, they tend to see these things as a sign from God.
Right.
And, you know, the key event at the time of this reporting was that big tsunami in Japan. So you remember there was that huge earthquake and then the tsunami rushed in, did, you know, billions of dollars of damage. It had that huge nuclear crisis with their nuclear power plant got flooded and the reactor almost melted down. Okay, so there's a perception that suddenly, you know, came to light that people look at this and they see the hand of God acting in our lives. So that brings us now to the next slide. So you see here geology in Japan. So there's one thing I really want to emphasize, because this was triggered by that tsunami in Japan and the earthquake. So the thing I want to emphasize is this idea that there's nothing magical about natural disasters, okay? So we're going to do a little quick geology lesson here, because it was actually really fun to study up on this, because it makes a nice, complete overshadowing of this idea of natural disasters and signs from God. So the first thing to realize, you know, where do earthquakes come from? You know, what causes an earthquake physically? You know, it's not God reaching down with his finger and shaking the earth around us. You know, there's a very natural process of subduction where tectonic plates collide into each other. So what you see here on the left is a graphic that you can actually find at just Wikipedia. And it just shows what an actual subduction zone looks like, where you have an oceanic tectonic plate just being forced underneath a continental tectonic plate. And so, you know, hopefully I don't have to explain plate tectonics to you. You know, just this idea of the Earth's crust is like these little rafts floating around and being forced into each other. But what happens is at these intersections of these plates where one gets forced underneath the other, you get a lot of elastic tension that builds up in the plate. And every now and then that tension just releases, and that's essentially what an earthquake is. It's just these tectonic plates cramming into each other, tension builds up and then releases. Okay. So wherever you have these intersections of tectonic plates, you have a strong tendency to see earthquakes. Another interesting thing is this is also the cause of things like volcanoes. That is, this one oceanic plate gets shoved underneath the continental plate. It tends to scoop up a bunch of ocean water with it. So as it goes further and further into crust, it obviously heats up. And when mixed, the rock and the ocean water together creates these little pockets of magma. And so magma is the stuff that liquefies, and then eventually, because it's sort of less dense than the rock around it, it pushes its way to the surface, and that's where you get volcanoes.
Got it.
So,
and Japan has lots of volcanoes.
Exactly. You know, I think a fun statistic is, you know, Japan is like 1/500th of the Earth's surface, but it has 1/10th of the Earth's volcanoes on it.
And it's not because the Japanese are wicked.
Yeah. So you look at the picture on the right here, and that shows the actual tectonic plate structure around Japan. There's actually four tectonic plates bashing into each other right underneath the Japanese mainland.
Ouch.
So it's no surprise that Japan is a geological hotspot. I got a little note here. Earthquakes with magnitude 7.0 or greater occur about 2 to 4 times per decade in Japan. I think another statistic is they'll have maybe 4.0 or less earthquakes almost daily. Okay.
Wow.
So the key take-home point from all this scientific rambling
is move.
Yeah.
Get out of there.
Even if all the people on Japan were just collectively moved to Alaska and the island was left completely bare, these things would still be happening. Okay. The earthquakes would still happen, and the volcanoes would still happen, and the tsunamis would still happen. So it has absolutely nothing to do with the people on top of the land. It's just a fact that geology is working its magic underneath. Okay, so that is a key principle I just want to emphasize with this discussion. There's nothing magical about this. There's nothing to do with the wickedness. Okay, even if the entire nation of Japan converted to Christianity and was living as absolute saints, you know, they'd still have this geology going on underneath them. They'd still have earthquakes. They'd still have volcanoes. And even if they all just became those horrible, wicked people in the world, you know, whole Sodom and Gomorrah type thing, you know, they'd have just as many earthquakes and volcanoes. So that is the real key thing. So when you look at like tornadoes, lightning, forest fires, and hurricanes, you know, there's nothing magical. There's just natural forces at play. And even if all human beings on Earth just collectively drop dead, these things would still just happen with or without us.
Right.
Okay.
And I'll just add that as a missionary, I purchased the 3-volume set of Doctrines of Salvation by Joseph Fielding Smith, mm-hmm. one of our former prophets. And he absolutely says in those books that natural disasters are the work of God. And so, you know, Mormons would come by these beliefs honestly if mm-hmm. they based their beliefs on the writings of Joseph Fielding Smith.
Yeah, you also have ideas of like the end times, of how they'll just, you can help me out here. Isn't one of the signs of the times this prevalence of disasters
yes.
and earthquakes as
yep.
well, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I hate to break it to you. I don't want to crush anyone's spirit, but you know, this is stuff that's been happening and will happen irrespective of how we're living or what day it is. It's just part of the fact that we live on a geologically active planet.
Okay. And so if religions say, hey, you know what, watch out for earthquakes and hurricanes and volcanoes and, you know, tornadoes as, you know, indications that that the end is near, then its followers are going to...
They can't go wrong.
That's right. They're going to win no matter what. Obviously, 20 million years ago or whenever the Ice Age happened, that was pretty catastrophic, but none of us were around to witness that, right? So it may have even been more catastrophic earlier, but we just weren't around to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, all this stuff happened before humans entered the scene, too.
Yep.
So now let's move along to slide 3 here. And this is an interesting little experiment. It's called the Scope of Teleological Thinking in Preschool Children. So this experiment was intended for preschool kids. So it's going to sound kind of, you know, dumbed down for, you know, in a very explicit way. So you'll kind of have to bear with me for that express reason. But the goal of this experiment was to just see how much children and adults see design in the world. So you've probably heard, you know, like the watchmaker argument or these arguments out of design. Another one of those God of the Gaps things.
Which is that, you know, if you found a watch on the sidewalk, you wouldn't assume that the elements just randomly organized to create the watch. You would assume that there was a watchmaker behind the watch. And if that's true, then if we have Earth and these beautiful humans and nature and honeycombs and you know, even, you know, hummingbirds that fly or bumblebees that logically can't fly but they still do, there must be, you know, there must be a divine creator that made all this. It's just too wonderful to have happened randomly.
Yeah, and there's a reason why this argument is so powerful, is because it resonates with a natural tendency in human thinking. That is, not only are we good at recognizing the design in something like a watch, but we see design in everything, whether there's design there or not. That's the key finding from this experiment.
Okay.
So it begins like this. We're just going to draw a distinction between this idea of made for a purpose and not made for any purpose at all. So this is a training exercise to build you up for the rest of the experiment. And you'll remember, this is intended for kids, so they explicitly had to explain this idea to them. And they had like a script they had to read too. And it kind of goes like this. You know, so you look at this, you see this. This is the tip of a pencil. The pencil tip is made for writing with. That is what it's made for. So then the experimenter points to this picture of pencil shavings over there on the right. And she says, but for some things aren't made for anything. You know, you see this pile of stuff, it isn't made for anything. It's just something that is there. Maybe somebody could use it for something, but it isn't made for anything. Okay, so that's the actual training script they would go through with these preschool kids.
Okay.
Just to emphasize in their brain that there are things made for something and there are things in this world not made for anything.
Right.
And your goal is to just simply spot the difference. Okay.
Right.
That's the essence of this experiment. So now we go to the next slide, slide number 4, this idea of made for something. So once you train these preschoolers, you show them pictures of various objects. So I have a list here: tiger, mountain, baby, finger, leg, cow, cloud, clock, tree, bird, jeans. Okay. You know, that's a list of some of the pictures you just hold up in front of this kid, and their job is to identify whether it's made for something or not made for anything. And in fact, just to like really force these kids into a dichotomous position, you invent these characters, Ben and Jane, who are describing this object. So an example would go like this. You hold up a picture of just a tiger in front of some preschool kid, and you say the following to them. Do you see this? This is a tiger. Ben, so you see the picture of Ben on the left. Ben says that a tiger is made for something. It could be that it's made for eating and walking and being seen at the zoo, or it could be that it's made for other things. But Ben is sure that a tiger is made for something, and that's why it's here. Okay, so that's the made for something position. And then you have Jane, who says that this is silly. A tiger isn't made for anything. Even though it can eat and walk and be seen at the zoo, that's not what it's made for. They're just things that it can do or people can do with it. Jane is sure that a tiger can do many things, but they aren't what it's made for, and they aren't why it's here. Okay, so that's the dichotomy you present to these kids. And then their job, you tell them the following. Point to who you think is right. Literally, all the kid has to do is hold up his finger in one direction or the other. So point to who you think is right. Ben, who thinks a tiger is made for something, or Jane, who thinks that's silly because a tiger isn't made for anything. Okay, so that's the whole experiment in a nutshell. And you just repeat this little game for all these various objects on the list. made for something, not made for anything, made for something, not made for something, and just go through the list and tally up the results. And then what they did, they also gave this experiment to adults so they can contrast how adults view the world with how children view the world. So now we are on slide number 5.
All right.
Which shows the results for this experiment here. And so you see a little bar, a set of bar graphs, and you notice it's contrasting children with adults, but they're also contrasting artifacts, which are man-made objects, and then biological organisms like tigers, and then natural objects like a mountaintop. All right, so we'll just look at the children bars first. And you see how children in all three categories are like 70 to 80% or almost 90% and above there. You see the three white bars.
Okay, so children tend to see most things as being made for something.
Exactly. They look at objects in the world and they see something that was deliberately put together.
Whether it's a pencil, which is an artifact, or an animal, which is a biological whole, or a cloud. They see all those things as being made for something.
Right. You know, and the key there is mountains and clouds. You know, so mountains and clouds are like definitely not made for anything. Like we said before, you know, mountains are like volcanoes and earthquakes. They're just geology working its magic and literally just piling dirt and rocks really, really high. That's what a mountain is. A big giant pile of rocks due to a bunch of geological forces. And in fact, the picture you see here is Mount Everest. Okay, and literally that's the result of the Indian subcontinent just bashing into the Eurasian continent, and just the dirt piles up as the continent moves in, or the tectonic plate just crams into the other one.
Right.
So it's not made for anything. It is about as random and purposeless as you can get. And same idea with a cloud. It's just this random hodgepodge of where water vapor happened to coalesce and condense and create, you know, a cloud. So to see this, children, when they look at this stuff, 70% and more look at mountains and clouds and will say, made for something. Mm-hmm. Now contrast this with adults. You see the adults there, it's about 30 to 40% of adults will look at mountains and clouds and say, this is made for something. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of interesting. It's about the same value that we saw before as the signs from God statistic. People just look at random stuff in the world and see design, even though there are definitely things in this world that are not designed at all. Now we go to biological wholes, you know, tigers and birds and cows. Now what's interesting is, you know, I hope this doesn't offend a few people, or maybe it'll probably be controversial, but biological organisms are not made for any purpose either. They are not technically designed. Okay, you know, the maker of a tiger is nothing more than evolution and natural selection.
In your view.
Yeah. As someone who's a scientist and someone who's, you know, studied biology, you know, when you really break it down, tigers, like, you know, biological organisms, like tigers and birds, you know, are the product of a long chain of inherited allele variations in reproductive populations after subjecting them to natural selection. You know, they do have an apparent design to them because they have complicated structures. But, you know, from a purely natural point of view, you know, there's nothing magical about them. Nothing came down. There's no blueprint for a tiger sitting around somewhere that somebody made. Okay, you know, they're going to continue to evolve and modify as time goes on. So to look at biological wholes and see design is not...
There's no evidence.
Yeah. There's no evidence for that. It's very natural to want to see design in these things.
In your view,
but,
yeah.
Right. Yeah, you know, but from my perspective, honestly, you know, they're not really designed. They're like mountains.
Right.
They're just products of nature. So that's an interesting statistic there, that even in this in-between zone where something, you know, probably isn't really designed either, we still see 70 to 80% of people, children and adults, look at tigers and birds and they see design, mm-hmm. something that was made. So that's the key finding from this experiment, is this overwhelming tendency to look at stuff in our world and see the action of some deliberate intention.
And I think that that's pretty easily explainable. My guess is that, you know, especially LDS people, but everyone, you know, Christians, probably all faith traditions, have this creation story where mm-hmm. God, where they're taught from a young age that God created the earth and mm-hmm. animals and humans, and that they all had a purpose. And, you know, I could even see why an adult would say that a mountain was created by God to allow us to ski and to, you know, allow us to mountain climb. Uh-huh. And again, I can see a scientific point of view that says there's no evidence, you know, no empirical evidence for any of that. And I can also see why adults and children would still see design and purpose without the evidence, right?
Well, there's one key piece of information that should be included in that discussion is the fact that this experiment was performed on preschool children. You know, people who are not indoctrinated with religious beliefs yet, or at least many of them, you know, we're talking about like four-year-olds. You know, does a four-year-old really kind of understand this stuff? And they're also from various mixed backgrounds. Some were, you know, Christian. Some were, you know, just secular parents too. So it's one thing to say that our culture kind of makes us look at the world this way, but when you do this on people who haven't really been influenced by that culture yet, and they overwhelmingly see design and everything, it means there's something innate to our brains themselves, our natural tendency. Yeah,
that's true.
It indicates very strongly, I could say.
I'll also say that I've taught Sunbeams in the LDS Church, and that's literally one of the lessons. And Sunbeams are like 2, 3, 4 years old, as I remember. Yeah. And you are taught literally that God makes the birdies, and God makes the clouds, and God makes the sunshine. So I think I can see your point, and I can also I have evidence for culturation or teaching, religious teachings to this effect at very young ages. So anyway, right. I'm not trying to undermine what you're saying.
Yeah.
I guess I'm saying I acknowledge your point, and I think there might be a lot of that going on as well.
Yeah, it is, you know, kind of difficult to decouple the culture because they are influenced at a very young age. But, you know, again, this was just a random sampling of preschool kids too.
It is interesting.
From various backgrounds.
Yeah, and it is interesting to see how adult how beliefs regarding design change over time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is interesting, right? That adults actually see 100% of artifacts as being designed.
Right.
So they actually see more design than children with artifacts. But then as you get to natural objects, that drops down to 30%. So it's pretty, it seems to be pretty significant that being an adult has a significant impact on whether you see design or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
But yeah, that sort of that lingering 30-40%, though, when you know you look at a cloud, is still an interesting statistic.
Yeah.
But in any case, that's the essence of the experiment, this tendency to see purpose in things.
Got it.
And this is just one out of a few I'm going to show,
sure.
Actually.
Okay.
So we go now to the next slide. There's this idea called agenticity. And this was coined by Michael Shermer, actually. And I thought it was a really great word to describe what we're talking about here. And he calls it the tendency to believe that the world is controlled by invisible intentional agents. Okay, so it's this idea, you look at stuff and it's not just the product of nature, but something deliberately put it there or made it that way or has its hand involved in its destiny and its progress. And so we're going to actually show where agenticity comes from an actual psychological perspective.
Got it.
So we go to the next slide here. So this is an idea called theory of mind, and it basically goes like this. You see these two pictures here. One is a rock and one is a baby, right? So you casually look at these things, and one of these objects you want to like hold and play with, right? And the other one you would just as soon step on it. Okay. Now, it seems really, really trivial, but it's important to realize that something in your brain made that distinction. And we'll show later on that not everybody has this immediate capacity, okay? But there exists in your brain some mechanism that's basically scanning the environment around you looking for other humans. And this is a really important idea to grab onto, that our survival as human beings depends on each other. So somewhere in there, nature has given us the power to look at objects in our environment and make a distinction between rocks and other things that are like us. Okay, and I specifically use vague terminology. As we're looking specifically for other human beings so we can interact with them, so we can cooperate with them and form relationships and work to our mutual survival and benefit and well-being. But, you know, it boils down to this idea of we're looking for things like us, things that are motivated, have intention and feelings, okay? And really ask yourself, what would it be like for a person who had trouble with this capacity, you know, who had difficulty empathizing with others and simply looked at people almost like stimulus from their environment, okay? And, you know, I say this specifically because not all animals have this capacity, like a frog or a snake, you know, can't really make this distinction. This is why they don't form highly sophisticated cultural groups. You know, as far as a snake is concerned, you're just stimulus from the environment. It doesn't look at you and have any capacity to see you as a motivated thing.
As far as we know.
Yeah, as far as we can tell, yeah. So that's a key principle, is in order to form cooperative groups, you have to have some capacity for recognizing others like you and working together with them. This is a fundamental key to what drives human success.
But snakes can. Every species has to replicate, to populate. A snake obviously can tell the difference between a male and a female snake, and it knows enough to be able to replicate, right?
Yeah, but I wouldn't go so far as to say that a snake has any empathy for you. You know, if you hold a snake in your arms, it doesn't really look at you and see something to interact with or cooperate with or to share feelings with or empathize with. That's kind of the distinction.
Would you say the more advanced the animal, the more chance there is that there is some of that, like maybe dogs or apes or something?
Yeah, definitely creatures like dogs almost certainly have this because they're pack animals. They're very social animals, okay, and they have to have some kind of structure for working together.
Got it.
And I would say cats have much less of this capacity because they're far more lonely in their lifestyle, or solitary is a better word.
Got it.
So that's kind of the key idea, is this ability to see others like you and especially to empathize with them, feel what they feel and work together with them.
Okay.
So now we go to the next slide, and this is going to further really drive home the point. So there's a phenomenon called pareidolia. And so this is a great little experiment because I just show you a bunch of pictures on the screen here. And so, John, how many faces do you see on this screen right now?
Okay, so I'm going to describe what I'm seeing to the listeners. I see a picture of Barack Obama on the left.
Yeah.
I see other objects to the right. There's four objects. One kind of looks like a face, but it also looks like it's almost an object on the moon, but I'm not sure what it is. But it's
actually the face on Mars.
Okay, so it kind of looks like a face, but it also looks like it's some type of planetary thing. Then below that, it looks like a piece of pizza on a piece of tinfoil.
It's actually a grilled cheese sandwich.
Okay. Oh, okay. Okay. That's grilled cheeses, basically.
It's actually the Virgin Mary in the grilled cheese sandwich.
Okay. There was a Glee episode where Jesus appeared on a grilled cheese sandwich, and they called it grilled Jesus. But it looks like there's a face in the grilled cheese sandwich.
Yeah, this is a really famous sandwich, by the way. I think some casino bought it for like $20,000 because it generated all this hype when the lady claimed that it had the Virgin Mary on it.
Fantastic.
So it's a really famous piece of grilled cheese sandwich. You see the big bite taken out of it, too.
Right. Yep, yep. And then on the right, I see what it looks like kind of like a candlestick, but the grooves in the candlestick look like two faces on either side looking at each other.
Yeah, it's that classic optical illusion of the vase with the faces.
Yep.
So you see two faces kind of into each other.
And then the last one is kind of like not a smiley face, but a straight face. It looks like a circle, two eyes, and then a line that looks like a straight mouth.
Yeah, you got a big circle for the head, two circles for the eyes, and just a straight line for that mouth. A blandy face, not really a smiley face.
So I could kind of see five faces, you know, if I look.
Six faces.
One, two. Oh, all right, six, yeah, if I look hard
enough.
Because the candlestick has two, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Now, only one of these images is an actual person, human face.
Right.
You saw how your brain immediately, without even trying, recognized faces in these other objects.
That's right.
So pareidolia is defined as seeing faces where there aren't actual human faces.
Okay.
And an interesting fact about facial recognition is that human brains are amazing at this. Okay, if you were to, you know, devise some kind of computer algorithm for recognizing faces and put it on your desktop computer, like, it could never hope to compete with your capacity, you know, of recognizing faces per second.
Right.
So this is something really hardwired into our brains, is to look for other faces. And we're so good at it that we see faces everywhere. Okay? And that's a key idea that I'm trying to sort of repeat and emphasize a lot, is that we're so good at looking for faces, even when there isn't a face. If it remotely has features of a face, our brain looks at it and sees a face and then recognizes the emotions in that face even.
You know, it's funny because my family and I went to Moab last week, and we went on this big long river raft trip all day long. And I haven't really thought about faces. I don't think about seeing faces other than when a news article comes out once every couple of years claiming that, you know, the Virgin Mary is on a refrigerator, you know, on the refrigerator panel or something. But the truth is, as we were gliding down the Colorado River, and our kids were looking up at the rock walls in Arches and in Moab, I think probably 10 times they said, "Oh, there's an old lady," or "Oh, there's an old man," right, you know, in the rock formation. So I don't think we trained them to do that, but I think that appears to be a natural tendency we have from my experience.
I would say this is biologically hardwired into our brains to look for faces.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a reason for that. Again, it's this idea that a huge part of our survival and prosperity as human beings requires us to work together.
Yeah.
To find other human beings, form relationships with them, empathize with them, and cooperate for our mutual benefit.
Yep.
Okay, this is a defining feature of what it means to be human, as opposed to virtually every other thing that's ever lived.
Right.
So, you know, imagine if you're born into this kind of culture and that part of your brain is broken. Okay, you're not quite as good at seeing faces as other people. You know, what is the evolutionary cost to that? Are you very likely to, you know, forge relationships and prosper and have lots of children, or, you know, will you just kind of get marginalized in the culture? So, from the perspective of evolutionary biology, there is a massive, massive bias towards social recognition.
Got it.
And in fact, and so much of a bias that we accidentally recognize each other everywhere, even where there isn't an actual person.
Right.
And that's a key idea, is, you know, compare and contrast the evolutionary cost of a false positive versus a false negative.
Right.
Okay, you accidentally see a face or see a person where there isn't one, you shrug it off or maybe do a rain dance and get on with your life, but you fail to see a person where there is one. You know, maybe he's not someone who likes you very much, and he bashes your head in with an axe and takes your stuff, and you don't go have any more babies. So just strictly biologically speaking, you know, there's this massive bias that we have to recognize each other. And there's so much of a urgency in this that we'll recognize each other even in ordinary, mundane things.
Got it.
Because the cost of that is so much less than the failure to do otherwise.
Okay, got it.
That's the theme I really want to push.
Okay.
So now we're going to do a really interesting experiment. So we're on slide number 9.
Okay.
And this is an idea called spontaneous social attribution. It's just a tendency to look at something and, without being told to, just completely spontaneously, you describe it and see it in terms of agents, this agenticity thing we talked about. So the experiment itself is actually really famous. It's called the Heider and Simmel experiment. And you can look this up on YouTube, and they'll show you the actual video footage of the experiment. So the essence of it goes like this. You get a bunch of just subjects, and you sit them down in front of a TV, and you tell them, you know, we're going to show you some video footage. And you give them a piece of paper and a pencil, and all you tell them to do is write down what you see. Okay? We're going to show you stuff, write down what you see happening. So the video itself is nothing more than these geometric objects moving around on the screen.
So a couple triangles and a circle in a box.
You see here kind of a still image of it. And like I said, you can watch the full movie online, but the essence of it is you have a little circle, a little triangle, a big triangle, and this rectangle thing that looks like a house.
With a door kind of thing.
With a door thing on it, yeah. So the little circle and the little triangle come in, they dance around each other, they move away, they come close, and they circle, and then the big triangle comes in and starts, you know, colliding with the little triangle and pushing it around, and they have what appears to be some kind of a struggle, and eventually culminates with some climax, and then they all leave the scene. Okay, that's literally all you see is a bunch of geometric shapes enter the scene, move around each other, and then they leave.
Right.
Now, out of 33 subjects, only one of them described it in literal terms. That is, a circle enters the scene, moves to the left, a small triangle enters the scene and follows the circle, a big triangle comes into the scene and collides with, you know, these are geometric descriptions of the literal events happening before you. The other 32 out of 33 subjects will say things like two lovers enter the scene. A jealous ex-boyfriend then follows them, tracks them, and picks a fight with... Okay, they just arbitrarily assign genders and feelings, motivations, and even backstories to these little geometric shapes.
Probably not arbitrarily. I mean, there's probably... Either a biological or some other type of social reason why we do this, right?
Yeah, we're hardwired, again, to see agents in the world.
Right.
And even if these agents are nothing more than... they're literally cardboard cutouts
in
stop-motion animation.
Yep.
And that's all they are. And we'll see intent and motivation in these little things.
Yep.
Now, what's really interesting, this is the key... is that if you show the same footage to people with autism, they will be far more likely to use the geometric descriptions rather than the social descriptions. So this is, you know, an interesting finding about autism is it heavily relates to our ability to recognize other human beings. You know, I mean, even the word autism itself literally means selfism. You have trouble empathizing and recognizing other members of your species or looking at things in your environment and seeing another person.
Right.
Okay, that's literally what severe autism creates in people. And we even know, at least partially, where some of that neurological basis is. You ever hear of a thing called mirror neurons?
No.
Well, there's a great article in Scientific American a few years back where they describe this. And the essence of it is when you look at another person doing like anything, like waving at you, there is a piece of your brain that vicariously replicates that experience in yourself. And you experience the wave in yourself, even though you're not actually waving. Okay. And that's what mirror neurons are. They're these neurons that fire when you see other people do things and give you the vicarious experience of doing what someone else is doing. So I guess a great way to demonstrate this is go to YouTube and watch, you know, skateboard accidents. And the next time the moment you see some guy fall off his skateboard and crush his crotch on something or, you know, bang his head into something really hard, you notice that feeling where you go, ooh, you know, that.
Yep.
You know, you could almost look at that as, you know, you're vicariously experiencing that other person's event, even though you're not actually experiencing it.
Yeah, another example of that is if you ever are watching a high jump event where people in a track and field do high jump, somebody runs up to try and jump over the bar, you'll often see people around or even yourself lift your leg as the other people are going through their high jumping motion. Yep, I used to do this as a high jumper. I was a high jumper myself, yeah.
So a key thing, though, is people with autism don't do this.
Right.
Their mirror neurons will not fire when they see other people doing things.
Right.
And it's actual, like, full fMRI studies of this, where they show, you know, ordinary people, and their mirror neurons light up when you see a person wave at you. And then autistic subjects, those same bundles of neurons don't fire when they see other people.
Right.
Okay. So I'm just trying to make the point that, you know, there is a neurological basis for our capacity to work as a social species. And it's possible to break that capacity. And there's a huge evolutionary push to, you know, make sure that capacity is hardwired into us and natural and normal.
Got it.
This experiment, I think, is really great because, like I said, it's just called Spontaneous Social Attribution, the Heider and Simmel experiment. And you can watch this yourself, and it's very hard to look at this and not see a struggle between people, even though it's just triangles in a circle. So it's a fun little experiment.
Okay. Yeah, I recommend it too.
So we go to slide number 10.
All right.
And this is an argument I'm making personally, is that these are all the ingredients you need to explain this idea of agenticity. That is, people have need for closure, which makes them susceptible to primacy. So whatever idea comes along first to fill a question, a lot of people just naturally grab onto that and then use that as the answer. But as we just learned, it's extremely natural, like hardwired into our brains, to look at the world and see agents. Things deliberately moving and shaking the environment. So it's not just that, you know, there are some answers more culturally prevalent than others. It's that our brains are physically hardwired to see agents in the world. And so that is the default answer our brain will fall towards in the lack of any other explanation, because we can't help it. So this, I feel, explains this tendency for agenticity in human populations, this overwhelming drive to see the world as controlled by things. Because you raise a question, your brain looks for an answer and invents its own natural answer that it's hardwired to invent, and then that fills your question. That fills your need for closure.
Got it.
Okay.
Got it.
So this takes us now to slide number 11. And at this point, I would say we have all the ingredients we need to explain where primitive religions originate. Okay?
Okay.
So I call this a cognitive theory of natural religion. So just to, you know, emphasize, is whether you are religious or not, you still have this question of where did religion come from? Where do all these other faiths originate from? How did they trace their origins? What was the genesis of some spiritual belief? So this is what we're going to answer. And there are actually scientists publishing books on this stuff. This one here on the left is called Born to Believe. It says God, Science, and the Origin of Ordinary and Extraordinary Beliefs. So that's an interesting book, just describing a lot of the various mechanisms by which we believe random stuff and see agents in charge of the world. This other book here called Why We Believe in Gods, the S is in parentheses, it's called A Concise Guide to the Science of Faith. It's actually only like 100 pages, a pretty quick read. But the essence of this guy is a clinical psychologist from the University of Virginia, I think. And he is basically going to make the exact same argument I am. This overwhelming tendency to see agents in the world forces us to see spiritual things in everything. And then the final book here you see, it says Psychology of Religion and Spirituality. This is actually a quarterly journal. So there's actual, like, full-blown journals dedicated to the study of this phenomenon, with people, you know, doing experiments like we've seen before and making discoveries almost daily. So what I'm going to show you is somewhat incomplete, but it is essentially the backbone framework that a lot of scientists are putting together. And we are getting very, very close to completely just building what I would call a neurological, psychological, and biological foundation for where religious beliefs originated and come from and propagate. Okay?
Okay.
So that's the big picture we're shooting for. So we go now to the next slide, slide number 12. And I think it basically all starts with, imagine a hunter-gatherer culture. Okay? So Homo sapiens as a species have been around for about 100,000 years, and 96% of that has been living out in the bush as a hunter-gatherer culture.
Right.
Okay, so I just got some picture of some African bushmen here. And they're just basically illustrative of what the vast majority of human history was like, living out, you know, in the wild in very close-knit social groups, or sort of clans, you could say. And this is how nature, I guess, intended us for us to be before we started building cities and sophisticated cultures. So first and foremost, a group like this is obviously going to be very scientifically naive. Okay, they don't know the first thing about the fact that the Earth is round, or that the Earth goes around the sun, or what the stars are. They just see a big mysterious world around them. But they are very inquisitive. So they want to answer these questions about the world. This is a huge part of human nature, is to ask questions and explore. They're going to be very superstitious, and a huge, huge fraction of their perception and behavior is going to be governed by, you know, the instincts nature has programmed into them. But the key is they're interdependent. Okay, this group, any individual in this group needs the group to survive. That's the defining characteristic of what it's like to live in this culture. Very, very highly social lifestyle with the capacity to look at other objects in your environment, identify other humans, and empathize with the humans, and even empathize with things that aren't people. That's kind of the key principle here. So we go now to the next slide, slide 13. This, I feel, perfectly explains where animism comes from. That is, the natural human tendency is to see everything in terms of agents with desires and motivations. So as an example, you see here some pictures of just random stuff. Like you got the ocean on the left, some lightning bolt in the middle, and some grass and wheat on the right. You know, imagine you're part of this culture and you see the ocean. You know, you don't know the first thing about what the ocean really is or what it's made up or made up of and what it's like. All you see is something that is sometimes rough, sometimes it's calm, sometimes it's warm, and sometimes it's cold, sometimes there's lots of fish, sometimes fishing is difficult. How do you explain this without any scientific framework? Because that's what people are going to do by their nature, is inquire.
Right.
And the default answer is to look at something like this and think something must be in charge of it. Something must be causing it intentionally. Okay, it has a personality. It has moods. It has motivations.
Right.
Okay, there is a spirit, a mind of the ocean, in effect. Same would go for things like the weather. You know, sometimes the weather is rough and vengeful, and sometimes the weather is calm and placid.
Right.
How does our human brain answer this stuff without any particular understanding of weather or electricity or fluid dynamics? You know, you just see something that varies in its intensity and helpfulness to you as a function of time, and by default you're going to look at this and just assume it's a personality. Something is angry at you, sometimes it's friendly with you, and so on. Maybe you could try and placate it and do a little rain dance, right? So
remind me what totemism is again.
Totemism is, well, I'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
So the key point of this is, I'm just going to state this as fact. Virtually all spiritual beliefs in hunter-gatherer cultures are based on some kind of animism, totemism, or an anthropomorphization.
Okay.
So animism is the idea of looking at an object in your environment and seeing a mind, an agent, okay, a spirit of the tree. You know, if I kick the tree, then the tree might, you know, feel pain from that. Okay, that's basically animism. Totemism is sort of a different form of animism that also adds the idea that we're related to things in our environment. That is, the tree isn't just a thinking spirit agent, but it's that spirit is actually my dead grandmother or my great grandmother.
Right.
That's basically what totemism is the objects in our environment are reflective of our relatives. We're related to them. They're like our ancestors, things like that.
Okay.
Anthropomorphism is simply giving these things human form, human shape. So, for example, you know, what's the ultimate difference between the spirit of the ocean versus Poseidon of the Greek pantheon? And right. Ultimately, the only difference is Poseidon has an actual human shape, whereas the spirit of the ocean is just the ocean with a motivational of intent.
Right.
Okay. So that is, in essence, where animism comes from. Our brains can't help but see agents as the movers and shakers of the world. And then since we live in these cultural groups where all our beliefs and our actions are heavily biased by peer pressure and culture, these ideas are just going to take root within the culture itself and, you know, feedback on themselves and reinforce each other. So given that, you know, what do you think is the natural tendency for these beliefs as time just wears on in generation after generation? As groups have to move and expand in new environments, what do you think these beliefs are going to do? And the short answer is, in principle, they should just follow the groups around and diversify with the groups. That is, as cultures encounter each other and compete with each other and encounter, say, new environments and have to adapt, then those beliefs buried within the culture are going to adapt with that culture. Okay. So in effect, we now come to slide 14. That idea predicts diversification with time. Okay, and that's actually exactly what we see in every major religion. So the chart you see here just says major branches within Christianity. And so what you see is sort of the stem of early Christianity branching off with the Council of Ephesus, you know, producing the Assyrian church, and then you have the Council of Chalcedon, or do I have that right? Yeah, producing Oriental Orthodoxy. Then there's the Great Schism of the 11th century, where you get Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodoxy. And then some of them reunite back together and then divide again with the Reformation and Protestants and Anglicans and Anabaptism and Restorationism. And you see, as time goes on, Christianity just branches and branches as time wears on. So these are just like the major sections of Christianity, not counting, you know, remember there's dozens upon dozens of subsects in Christian faith. So there's a word for something like this in biology. That is, when you trace the lineage of something and you see it branching and branching at various points in time, we call that a cladogram. Okay? And the thing to realize, when you see a cladogram, something branching and diversifying as time goes on, there is only one thing in the entire known universe that explains this behavior, and that is evolution through natural selection. Okay. Maybe there's another explanation, but I have not seen
it. In biology,
yeah. But, you know, all the elements are there. You know, these beliefs are formed by culture and formed by groups. They are competing with each other for scarce resources and for belief within the members of those groups. And so they have to just diversify and adapt to suit environments. That's the essence of what evolution and natural selection entails, is this diversification and sophistication as time wears on and generations within generations start, you know, trying out variations and mutating, so to speak, their ideas within their cultures. So this is a prediction of what we should expect given the conditions, and it's exactly what we see.
Right.
And I should point out, you know, I'm picking on Christianity here, but every major religion has these schisms.
Yep.
Okay, Islam has dozens of
Judaism, Hinduism, they all
Judaism. Go. Yep. Hinduism and Buddhism, yep. They all show this sort of branching behavior, where just more and more varieties keep emerging as time goes on.
Yep.
So, you know, I can't think of any explanation for this other than just what I've stated.
Yep.
You know, it's cultural group selection in a nutshell. So remember at the beginning of this discussion how we showed all the major subsects within Christianity and all the major beliefs around the world. You know, this explains it. This is a perfectly valid theory grounded in empirical science that explains this behavior and where it comes from. So that leads us now to slide 15. So what you see here is kind of a flow chart of the process. So this is something I kind of put together based on what I've been able to glean from the literature, is this idea where you start with, you know, hunter-gatherer cultures and a propensity for agenticity, and those things come together to give you animism. Animism then couples with culture to produce, you know, sophisticated religions with their own mythologies and spiritualistic beliefs, which then, coupled with group selection, gives you a diversification and sophistication with time. So the key point to this is there is no ultimate religion that humanity is going to converge into. We're just, you know, all things being equal, the result is just going to be branching upon branching and diversification. But you're not going to see faiths converging together.
Or extinction,
true,
right?
Yeah. You do see extinction. You know, how many subsects of various religions do you think have died off? You know, do you see a Greek pantheon anywhere?
Right.
How many people believe even Zeus these days? So. Yeah, I should actually include extinction in that chart as well. That's a good point.
Yeah.
So this is the backbone framework for how religion originates, how it spreads itself, and how it behaves under successive generations. And you see these little boxes down here in the corner. I say mythology, origins, death, and morality. These are, in my opinion, sort of unknowns because they're unifying themes that you see in a lot of religious beliefs around the world. That is, they all have some kind of mythology of a great hero triumphing over things. They like to talk about origins, where everything came from. They definitely obsess over death. That's a huge underlying theme in spiritual beliefs, is what happens after we die. Yep. And you also see a lot of religion coupling itself with moral behavior. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, morality tends to reflect the culture in which it's born, which also couples itself with the religious and spiritual beliefs. So they tend to intertwine themselves a lot as well. Yep. But it's really kind of unclear how they seem to make their way in there. So I kind of left them off in the corner as, you know, maybe if you want to go study psychology and get your PhD, you could take part in the research that fills that death block in there somehow and explains why that tends to intertwine so much. Right. But this is the process right here. This is how it begins and how it behaves as time goes on.
Okay.
So next slide, we're on slide 16, and you just see the big picture. So we alluded to this with that chart earlier with religious boundaries in the U.S., and now we're basically seeing that same chart only reflecting the entire world. And you can obviously see religious beliefs follow very distinct cultural boundaries.
And geographic,
cultural geographic boundaries. Yep. You know, this would make no sense if there was some ultimate true religion that everyone was trying to converge to. But it makes perfect sense if it's a product of the culture which gave birth to it. So, you know, for example, you see all these subsects of Christianity, you know, breaking up the United States. There's a little Mormon blob there in Utah, Idaho. You see big chunks of the world have sort of primal indigenous religions, like way up there in northern Canada and Alaska and parts of Siberia. You see, obviously, the Middle East is broken down between Islam, where you have Sunnis and Shiites in various regions. You see Hindus right there in India. The entire Indian subcontinent is just all Hinduism.
Right.
big chunks of China and Tibet are all Buddhism. You can see Eastern Orthodoxy there in Eastern Europe and sort of the areas like the Ukraine.
Yep.
Just very, very distinct cultural boundaries across the world.
Yeah.
You know, this, again, makes perfect sense if you look at it in terms of a product of the culture itself. And it makes no sense if you look at it in terms of some ultimate truth that everyone's trying to converge to. So hopefully this picture now should be perfectly well explained. You should look at that and think, oh, yeah, that's natural. Of course it's that way. At least that's kind of the goal. Whatever belief you are, you still have to recognize the significance of this image, that there's all this grab bag of religious beliefs out there, and you know, where did they come from?
To be honest, the only other explanation or theory that I've ever heard of this diversity was stuff that I read on my mission from a general authority of the LDS Church, which is basically that in the pre-existence, we had different levels of righteousness or valiancy. And depending on our level of righteousness or valiancy in the pre-existence, we were assigned to a specific region or culture or religion based on what we earned in the previous life. And that's the only other attempt I've heard to explain. And they even had, like, you know, like white Christian was at the top, and then there was like Asian, and then there was like, you know, brown people and then black people. And there was even this gradation of his attempts to decide what the hierarchy was of valiancy as associated with race and culture. And that's the only that's the only other attempt I've heard to try to explain this.
Yeah, you got to be really careful if you say that out loud to people, because you're basically saying my belief is superior to yours because I'm more righteous than you were in the pre-existence. You know, that's kind of a slap in the face if you say that to a Muslim or a Buddhist.
Right.
You know, I'm higher up on the hierarchy, the totem pole, than you are. You know, I was more valiant. You know, that's kind of you know, if I heard that, and I was a Hindu, I'd be kind of offended. You really should be careful of that sort of idea. And So now we're on slide 17. And this just is a plug for my YouTube channel, Anti-Citizen X. a lot of these experiments we've talked about, I have actual sort of video presentations of them where I'll show, you know, some religious claim contrasted with the scientific demonstration of the psychological mechanism that makes these claims so compelling. And so I have this 10-part video series called The Psychology of Belief, just really spelling out all these various things we've talked about and a few extra that we didn't talk about. For example, we didn't talk about projection. So that's actually kind of a fun one, is people tend to see faults in themselves and then project it onto other people as a mechanism for feeling better about themselves. It's kind of interesting. I also do some other videos periodically on just general philosophy of science and skepticism as well. So that's my shameless plug for myself.
Good, good.
So now we're on the final slide, just our final concluding section. This is pretty text heavy, so I just wanted to kind of read a few remarks, just summarizing the things we've learned. So first and foremost, we've shown that there is a scientific theory of religion, which is pretty well grounded. We've demonstrated all the key elements of it. Just says religious and spiritual beliefs are derived from the natural human tendency to perceive the world in terms of personally motivated agents. When coupled with cultural groups and natural selection, the result is diversification and sophistication over time. Okay, we've seen all of these elements in action. So now I'm going to really be frank and upfront here. I'm going to say very bluntly that all religious and spiritual organizations, without exception,
in your opinion,
in my opinion, yeah, this is now my personal conclusions from what we've discussed. Without exception, you know, all religious and spiritual organizations are cultural phenomena. Okay, we have this theory that explains them all and shows them all, and they behave exactly as you would expect if they are determined by culture. And they rely on social pressure, cognitive dissonance, manipulation tactics, sales tactics, hallucination, and perceptual bias in order to survive and to propagate. Because remember, each time we did one of these, we've seen how you can exploit this mechanism to generate real belief, and that people genuinely do exploit these things. Okay, so it's no wonder people believe this stuff, is because the beliefs are driven by these biases in our thinking that are guaranteed to make us believe anything. So by itself, that's not really a bad thing, I should say. You know, it's just part of our culture. You know, the same thing happens with Pokemon. Why do people like Pokemon? Well, because it got popular and people were pressured into it. And it became this self-reinforcing thing. Same thing would be true for fashion trends every year. You know, there's nothing particularly wrong with it as long as you recognize it for what it is. The danger in this is when you start generating staunch personal convictions without any regard for empirical evidence and rational skepticism. That is, that's where you start getting into the world of dogmatic assertions that affect everybody, that people start acting on their beliefs in ways that affect the people around them and do so without any care for evidence, for facts. Okay, that's the real thing to beware of when we're talking about cultural phenomena this way. Okay?
It's sort of this confidence that you've got a special claim on an understanding of how God works, and that it just so happens to work in your favor, and not in other people's favor. Another way I've heard someone say this is, there's never ever been a group of people that have received a revelation from God that those other guys over there were God's chosen people. In other words, everyone thinks that they're chosen by God and doing what is right, but they never happen to sort of get that revelation on behalf of others. It's always privilege to the people receiving whatever they're receiving. Is that right?
Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. It's very self-serving in that bias. And, you know, like I said, you know, I remember growing up LDS, where this was really driven into me as, you know, we are the one true church and everyone else is just sort of misguided and lost. And I had no idea that other people say the same thing about us. So you really have to ask yourself, you know, on what basis do you make this assertion? And physical evidence is kind of the ultimate arbiter of stuff. But if you're going to ignore facts, then that makes you a dangerous person in a dangerous ideology. So I really just want to emphasize, you know, facts matter, because that's kind of all we have to arbitrate right and wrong in this world, is is the world itself. So kind of a final remark on this is we live in a world that I would say is flooded with superstition, misinformation, ignorance, bamboozle, scarcity, hatred, greed, corruption, and maybe not so much today, but 20 years ago, I would say the grim specter of nuclear annihilation. Okay, we live in a world where there exists weapons of mass destruction and people who want to use them. Okay, people have fingers on buttons right now, ready to push at the slightest provocation. So, you know, do you want to live in a world where people make dogmatic assertions about their beliefs as being superior to others? Or do you want to live in a world where people are more rational and open to facts and discussion? So I would conclude by saying, you know, scientific method is the best and the only tool we have for mitigating the pitfalls in human reasoning and really illuminating our darkness and superstition. That is, as we've gone through all these psychological biases, we've seen how science is designed to counteract them, to keep us from falling into those traps. So people who reject science scare me, because it's an idea that you don't acknowledge the faults in yourself and your capacity for being wrong about things. So I should say, only by learning to embrace, not ignore, but embrace the cognitive shortcomings, which we've seen, nature is programmed into our brains for good reasons, but only by learning to embrace them can we ever hope to overcome their negative consequences. That is, you can't undo your bias unless you understand what the bias is in the first place and what triggers it, so that you can then take active measures to counteract it. Okay, so that to me is the beauty of science in a world of cultural superstition.
Got it.
Okay. So, and that I would just say, I say that in the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
Oh.
Sorry.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. 'Tis better far to drive, do this and joy. Your hearts will swell, oh, all is well, all is well. Why should we mourn? I think our lot is hard, 'tis not so. Should we die before our journey's through?